Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 17th of November. This hour of the program, we talk about health care reform. This hour, a special emphasis on the pharmaceutical industry. Many lobbyists are at work in Washington, D.C., as Congress completes a health care reform bill. These figures are pretty astounding. There are 3,000 registered health care lobbyists on Capitol Hill, six for every single member of Congress. And in many cases, as you know, lobbyists are former members of Congress who shaped laws that benefited the industry that they joined. New York Times had an interesting article yesterday on how the price of drugs has gone up as healthcare reform gets closer to being passed. Maybe it will be soon that it will be passed. Maybe it won't be passed. We'll see. But the industry has been raising its prices at the fastest rate in years. In the last year, the industry has raised the wholesale prices of brand name prescription drugs by about 9%, according to industry analysts. It will add more than $10 billion to the nation's drug bill, which is on track to exceed $300 billion a year. The drug makers have promised to support Washington's health care overhaul by shaving $8 billion a year off the nation's drug costs, but this is an interesting story about how the prices have gone up. We have two guests with us this hour to talk about health care reform and the influence of lobbyists and how we pay for this and the pharmaceutical industry. Dr. John Abramson has worked as a family doctor in Appalachia with the National Health Service Corps and for 20 years in Hamilton, Massachusetts. He's on the clinical faculty at Harvard Medical School where he teaches health policy, and he is author of The Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine, which was published in 2004. Dr. John Abramson, thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Also joining us for the first part of the program is Rebecca Adams, senior writer at Congressional Quarterly Weekly. And Rebecca has an interesting article in the current weekly, November 16, Congressional Quarterly. The House and Senate have devised fundamentally different approaches to taxation in their overhauls, and public acceptance could hang in the balance. Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you.
Could we start, both of you? I think this figure is just astounding. The number of lobbyists for each member of Congress who are obviously influencing them when it comes to health care reform. Rebecca, you want to start?
Well, it is pretty astounding. The industry has spent about $200 million on lobbying so far this year, which is a little less than last year, but it will be more by the end of the year when we see a lot of activity on health reform. The Trade Association for the Drug Industry itself spent about $20 million this year. So, you know, what we as reporters see often on Capitol Hill is people who have worked on Capitol Hill often then go to represent the industry. And we see that certainly at pharma. A former member, Billy Tozan, who was a Republican from Louisiana and a key member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, the chairman, then, and also very involved in writing the 2003 prescription drug bill, then went on to be the president of the Drug Industry Trade Association. So there is a lot of cycling back and forth and a lot of activity. What the drug makers would say is that this is their constitutional right to petition the government, and that it helps when business is able to provide Congress with information about how things would actually work.
Mm-hmm. And Billy's making something like $2 million a year, isn't he?
He's doing okay for
himself. He's doing okay. Dr. Abramson, how did you see this? How have you seen this as a doctor in the medical profession, the influence of lobbyists?
Yeah, well, the influence of lobbyists and the influence of the pharmaceutical industry in general, and this is an extremely important issue because the core issue here is that the pharmaceutical industry is a business, and their responsibility is to their shareholders and investors to maximize their profits, and that they do very well. And part of maximizing those profits is hiring those lobbyists to the extent that they're cost effective. And we'll get into talking about advertising and marketing and financing research. But basically what's happened is that the knowledge base that physicians rely upon and must rely upon has been almost completely privatized over the last 30 years. So it's not just that the pharmaceutical industry has healthcare industry has 3,000 lobbyists in Washington. It's that they are pretty much controlling what your listeners' doctors believe is the right way to practice medicine. And that's the core issue when we look at the poor performance overall of the American healthcare system, when we see we're spending twice as much as the other industrialized countries per person, and yet Americans live 2.5 years less in good health.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about how they're controlling this.
Well, if you look at the knowledge side of it, which is where I spend most of my time and what I addressed in Overdosed America, about 85% of clinical trials are now commercially funded. And we know that even amongst the highest quality clinical trials, the ones that are deemed well enough done to be included into Cochrane reviews, that the odds are 5 times greater that a commercially funded trial will conclude that the sponsor's drug is the treatment of choice, mm-hmm. compared to non-commercially funded trials of exactly the same drugs. And we're seeing more and more detail coming out. There was just an article in last week's New England Journal about how this happened with the blockbuster drug Neurontin. But the journal articles that doctors look at are largely funded by the drug companies. The guidelines that inform physicians about how they're supposed to practice medicine, 59% of the experts who write those guidelines have financial ties to a drug maker that has a drug that's being considered. When doctors go to their continuing medical education to get their 50 hours of educational participation a year, about 70% of those activities are funded by the pharmaceutical industry. And you see through the process of litigation, I serve as an expert to plaintiffs' attorneys, and when you get to see the confidential documents, you see how the drug companies kind of create a surround sound environment so that wherever physicians turn to turn for information about how to best serve their patients, even in the doctor's lounge, the drug companies and their so-called educational subsidiaries and consultants know how to create their buzz, how to get their version of the science into the doctors so that doctors are thinking at best about ways to practice medicine that will maximize the drug company's return on investment, and at worst are convinced to practice to prescribe dangerous drugs, and even more important, forget that the best way to prevent serious illness and to maintain health usually has to do with positive lifestyle modification instead of turning to these blockbuster drugs.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, when you look at the House legislation in the Senate, although they haven't passed it yet, how do they deal with the issue of controlling costs within the pharmaceutical industry? How do they deal with the fact that the drug industry has increased prices 9% on drugs in the last year?
Well, first, I should let you know what the drug industry would say in rebuttal to that argument.
Sure.
They would say that, you know, the average wholesale price, often what people call it, is it ain't what's paid, that there are often rebates in Medicare and Medicaid that would discount the prices. And so if you're looking just at the prices, then that's not a fair representation of what people actually pay for the drugs. They also say that they're under increasing pressure because of the increased use of generics and that they've lost 60,000 jobs this year because of the pressures that they face. And they always note that research and development costs are often around $1 billion to develop a drug. So that's their statement. I would point out that the House bill is fairly assertive in trying to get some control over the drug industry. They would seek to cut about $14 billion a year over a decade, and that's in contrast to what the Senate and the White House have gone along with, which is $8 billion a year over a decade. Either one is fairly manageable for the drug industry, and so I think that, you know, as you noted earlier, that the nation's drug bill is about $300 billion a year. So it's we see a more assertive, aggressive stance in the House bill, and we'll see whether that survives going forward. The White House has asked for significantly less than that.
Mm-hmm. Do either of the bills look at the enormous amount of money that must be spent on advertising drugs?
They they don't really get it that directly. That was something that was addressed a couple of years ago in the 2007 FDA bill. There was an FDA reauthorization bill that did put some increased limits and gave the FDA a little more authority over drug marketing. And we're seeing the FDA director, Peggy Hamburg, look at that very closely.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Abramson, what do you make of the fact that they have lost jobs this year, that they need to spend a whole lot of money in giving us the best drugs to fight diseases that affect many of us?
Very true. First of all, about jobs, I think we saw 10,000 jobs disappear when Pfizer announced that it was going to purchase Wyeth for $68 billion. Using $22 billion worth of TARP money. That was actually the first TARP money that was recirculated. And in the process of the consolidation, they're going to lay off 10,000 workers. So it's a little bit hard to have sympathy for using public money, bailout money, to be laying off 10,000 American workers. Now, it is very expensive to bring drugs to market, and God knows we need drugs, and we always need better drugs, and we want to create an environment that will motivate the drug industry to continue to produce better drugs. But that said, year in, year out, the drug industry has shown the greatest profitability of any industry in the United States, actually three times greater profitability than the average Fortune 500 company. The drug industry makes about 17% profit on its sales, and the rest of the Fortune 500 companies make only about 5% of profit on sales. So it's hard. The arguments don't quite add up, and what you've got is an enormously powerful industry that has where things are going in their favor. I mean, we in New Zealand are the only two countries that allow direct-to-consumer advertising the way we have it on television and in the print media. And we've had a major sea change in the way drugs are paid for during the last decade of the 1990s, where consumers started to be covered by managed care and got a lot more drug coverage so that their out-of-pocket costs were much lower as the advertising came on like a tsunami. So what we've got is a market that doesn't work like a market. So the drug industry has taken over the advertising awareness of consumers. While they've gained large control over the articles that are published in the journals and the guidelines, and yet consumers don't have to pay very much out of pocket for these drugs. So we've got an unbalanced situation where the market can't work, and we've got a wonderful natural experiment in the United States because our market for generic drugs works very well. And in fact, generic drugs are less expensive in the United States than they are in many other countries, whereas our brand name drugs are 40, 50, 60% higher than they are in other countries.
That's pretty high. Rebecca, let me just ask you, because I know you're with us for a limited time, a couple things. What about these stories, and I'm wondering how this happened, statements by more than a dozen lawmakers that were pretty similar, that were put in the congressional record, and they were written by the drug companies? What is this story?
Yes, it's pretty interesting. This is from a New York Times story by Robert Pierre a couple of days ago. He discovered that numerous lawmakers from both parties, Democrats and Republicans, had inserted remarks that were written by a drug company, that were written by the lawyers and lobbyists for a drug company, and they all make similar points, talking about the jobs that are produced by supporting the drug industry and so forth. And it's pretty shocking to the average American voter, but it's sadly pretty commonplace. I mean, often as a reporter, you'll find out what's going on with a bill quicker from a lobbyist than you will from a lawmaker. So, yes, these lobbyists do have a strong hand in writing statements that are put in the congressional record and, in fact, writing the bills.
Hmm. Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us. Just when do you think the Senate's going to act on health care reform?
Well, there is talk today of moving to a motion to proceed on Friday that would allow them to start the debate, but it may not even start until next week. So we're just in a holding pattern. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is waiting for cost estimates from the Congressional Budget Office, which are not yet back.
Okay, thanks, Rebecca. We're continuing our conversation. Rebecca Adams with us, the first part of the show, senior writer for Congressional Quarterly Weekly. Dr. John Abramson is with us the full hour. He is author of Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. He's on the clinical faculty at Harvard Medical School, where he teaches, and he serves as an expert for plaintiffs, attorneys, and litigations involving the pharmaceutical industry. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Join the conversation whenever you'd like. I would think that once we get rolling, we'll have a lot of phone calls. So join us soon. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Join our conversation on the pharmaceutical industry. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And our guest now, Dr. John Abramson, he has worked as a family doctor for a number of years. He teaches at Harvard now, and he's the author of Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. We welcome your phone calls for him. Let's go back to the issue of advertising for just a moment, Dr. Abramson. We were talking about this a little bit yesterday with Charlie Peters from the Washington Monthly. And he was saying that there was a time when we didn't have advertising. Was it outlawed on television in this country and radio for a number of years?
It didn't happen. It wasn't really outlawed, but the pharmaceutical industry abided by the FDA's advice not to advertise. And the floodgates really opened in two stages. In the very late 80s and early 90s, advertising became allowed. But the FDA had a rule that there had to be extensive presentation of the risks and potential side effects of the drugs. Excuse me. So that curtailed advertising on TV quite a bit, because the advertising time would have had to be consumed by these disclaimers of risks and side effects. In 1997, the rules changed so that the FDA allowed media advertising without full disclosure of the risks, and that's why you see on television ads CR advertisement in Shape magazine or call an 800 number for more information. That's to fulfill the FDA's requirement that there's more advertising. But with that, we saw the expenditures on advertising explode, and advertising has become a major factor in consumers' impression of both how to approach their health care in general, using drugs and procedures that generate a good return on investment for the manufacturers, as well as demanding specific brand name drugs. And from my point of view as a family doctor, that has been more negative than positive, because it sets up a sort of a power relationship between the patient and the doctor, with the patient often demanding a certain kind of medicine and not participating as a partner with the physician in the decision.
Mm-hmm. The pharmaceutical industry must spend an enormous amount of money on advertising.
They do, billions. Absolutely, and they know well what the return on investment is.
Yeah.
And let me give you an example, Kathleen, of how that advertising can be dysfunctional. The page in the New York Times, occasionally a newspaper page, has stories in juxtaposition that really tell the story. And yesterday's story in the New York Times, the continuation of the article titled "Drug Firms Raise Prices Ahead of Healthcare Shift," the story on the bottom of the page is "Study Raises Questions About Cholesterol Drugs Benefit." And that's about drugs called Zetia and Vytorin.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very interesting story about those drugs. The key drug is ezetimibe, which lowers cholesterol by decreasing absorption from the gut. The statin drugs decrease cholesterol by decreasing production in the liver. And this drug was approved by the FDA in 2002, not because it improved people's health. There was no evidence that it improved people's health, but simply because it lowered cholesterol. And Merck made a promise that it would do clinical trials to determine what effect it had on health. Well, Merck completed its first trial in April of 2006, which showed no benefit for the drug ezetimibe. It didn't make the results of that trial known for 20 months.
Oh, my.
And the year in between, Merck spent $200 million advertising to consumers, showing them that this drug lowers cholesterol. Well, Merck knew that its first clinical trial showed no clinical benefit, but doctors didn't know and patients didn't know.
Mm. Are they paying the consequences of that?
They're paying the consequences
today.
By having sold $4.6 billion worth of the drugs last year.
And it's done nothing for people.
No. In fact, the story came out and the stock analyst said that Merck stock would go up because the latest study that came out at cardiology meetings on Sunday showed not that the drug was beneficial, but that it wasn't actively harmful, that it was just neutral, was good news for Merck.
Wow.
Spending $4.5 billion. So in healthcare reform, Kathleen, we're having a trouble as a nation getting a handle on this idea that we could contain healthcare costs and improve the quality of our healthcare at the same time.
Yeah.
And then we see these stories like Victoria's Secret story, but we see that we're spending.
I need to interrupt you for just a second here, doctor, because your phone, I don't know if it's a cell phone you're on, but we're not hearing your words all of a sudden. So it's important to hear you. We'll try and get this figured out. We're talking about the pharmaceutical industry and welcoming your phone calls for Dr. John Abramson. We'll try and get him on another phone line so that we can hear him better. He is the author of Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. He teaches at Harvard, and he's worked as a family doctor for a number of years in Appalachia with the National Health Service Corps and also in Hamilton, Massachusetts. He teaches health policy there, and he also serves as an expert for plaintiffs' attorneys in litigation involving the pharmaceutical industry. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you would like to send us an email, and we do have a couple of those I've just noticed, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. This may also be a conversation you want to carry on as long as we have a moment here trying to reconnect with the doctor. We do have a Facebook page now. I'm kind of into Facebook, and many of you are as well, so we continue some of our conversations, and you can respond to some of the guests we've had if you go to WPR.org and then find Kathleen Dunn and hit that. You'll find a way to become a fan if you'd like, and then we can talk to each other about some of these issues. All right, we're trying to reconnect with the doctor. We have a ton of phone calls that have come in now. The second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about trying to find the truth on television. And so we have him with us. Dr. Abramson, are you there?
I think I'm back.
Yeah, you are back.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
My phone cut out.
I know.
So what I was saying was that we have trouble in this healthcare reform. This is the greatest opportunity, I think, of my lifetime to fix what is a very broken system. And the real core issue that we're wasting about a third of our healthcare expenditures, we're wasting somewhere around $800 billion a year on healthcare that's not helpful and maybe harmful, has gotten pushed to the back burner because people are afraid of rationing and people are afraid of death panels and killing granny. And what we see when we look critically at the medical literature and when we see the truth that comes out in litigation is that there are enormous opportunities to save money and practice better health care. And this Vytorin story that I was telling, Vytorin and Zetia story, is just one example. We're spending $4.5 billion a year on drugs that have never been proven to have a clinical benefit. They do lower cholesterol, but they've never been proven to have a clinical benefit. The drugs are being advertised very heavily, and consumers and doctors are picking up that advertising, and we're just wasting this money when we should be spending that money, that $4.5 billion, on helping Americans to understand that the overwhelmingly effective way to prevent heart disease and decrease the risk of recurrent heart disease is to exercise daily, to eat a healthy diet, and to not smoke. And that message gets crowded out because so much of the knowledge, and I put quotation marks around knowledge, so much of the knowledge that comes to physicians and to consumers comes through a commercial filter, so that the ways to approach health that aren't profitable get crowded out.
Right. And I'm a little confused. Where are we wasting all those billions? From advertising, are you saying, or something?
Well, we're wasting them in multiple ways. I mean, we're wasting them. Drugs are, to be fair, drugs only account for about 12% of our total healthcare spend. So the increased prices and increased utilization of expensive medications explain only a small part of that waste, but in a large way, the tail wags the dog on this, because it's the knowledge about how to practice medicine that's produced by the drug industries and the medical device industries that shows that leads our healthcare to be very technically oriented, to adopt new and expensive drugs and technologies before they've been proven to work. So that's one major way that we're wasting that money. Another way is that our entire healthcare system functions as a for-profit system, so that even nonprofit hospitals have a tremendous incentive to provide the services and expand the services that are going to be financially most advantageous for them. So we get, for example, more cardiac catheterization and coronary artery bypass surgery operating rooms, rather than the kind of outreach that would prevent the need for those services. Or MRI machines come online not because there's a public need for them, but because the accountants say that you can make money with them. And we have more MRI machines here in Massachusetts than there are in all of Canada. Canada's spending about half as much as we are on healthcare, and their healthcare statistics are much better than ours.
Let's get a phone call. Scott from La Crosse is first. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Thanks again. Another wonderful program. My question is, and I'm going to have to apologize, because what I heard this a couple years ago, and, you know, I'm old and forgetful. I'm waiting for a drug that'll make me remember better. But I heard a woman who was a physician, a professor, much probably in the same vein as your current guest. And she was critical, very critical of the pharmaceutical industry. And she was saying that the pharmaceutical industry makes the case that we need huge profits because we have huge overhead, because we're doing a whole lot of research and development of new products. And she said, you got to take that with a huge grain of salt, because they really, a lot of the research and development actually occurs at universities, and the drug companies pirate off that, or well, they access that. And I guess that my question is, can you discuss that role exactly? And was she accurate in saying that a whole lot of the research and development, supposedly money on producing new product, is really kind of fudged around, so that what they're actually doing is incorporating a lot of money that they use to push new product in those categories?
Scott, that's an excellent question, and it brings up a number of very important issues. What you're referring to is the conduct of basic sciences, basic science research in universities and publicly funded by the National Institutes of Health. So you get public money funding the infrastructure science, and then that science gets turned over to the commercial entities, and they can commercialize it and develop new drugs. Now, it is very expensive to bring a drug to market. It costs about $1 billion. There's no question about that. But the fact is that the pharmaceutical industry, when you take in all the expense, all the risk, the failures, everything else, the short patent life, everything else, the pharmaceutical industry has more than three times higher profit margin than the other Fortune 500 companies. And another issue, Scott, that I want to address that you kind of tangentially bring up is the idea that 60% of the pharmaceutical industry's profits come from the United States. And it's imperative to continue the profitability in the United States, because our pharmaceutical companies are doing the bulk of the world's research. And if we get the profitability in the United States down to where it is in other countries, we'll choke off the research and development activity. That's just not true. In the United States, we have about 40% of the GDP of the wealthiest countries, and we develop about 40% of new drugs, and the other industrialized countries carry their weight as well. Some produce more in proportion to their GDP and some less, but we're right in the middle of the pack. So we're producing about 42% of new drugs, I believe is the statistic, but 60% of profits are coming from the United States. And that just doesn't add up. And it's the pharmaceutical industry is very good at doing what it is supposed to be doing, which is maximizing its profitability. I'm not critical. It's hard to I wouldn't say I'm critical of the pharmaceutical industry because they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. It's the context in which the pharmaceutical industry is operating that's the problem. So that I think the rules of the game need to change so that the profitability of the pharmaceutical industry is contingent upon them delivering products that improve our health at a fair price. And that's the problem, is we don't have that environment in which this commercial activity is taking place.
Thanks, Scott, very much for your call. Jane from Gays Mills. Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Jane.
Recently on Wisconsin Public Radio, there was an author of a book, I believe it was called What the Drug Companies Won't Tell You and Your Doctor Doesn't Know. So I bought the book, and I was very impressed with the information that I got from there. In particular, drug companies in the U.S. are spending in the U.S. approximately $60,000 per physician. And I really want to urge people to contact their own doctors and find out what their clinic, hospitals, practices regarding pharmaceuticals and their advertising. And it's just amazing the amount of money that's being spent on that. And I know that the hospital that I work for recently stopped allowing the advertising and such. We were told to take any drug company-related notepads, pens, whatever, and remove them, that they would no longer be supporting that in our hospital, and that very much impressed me.
Well, Jane, your hospital is clearly on the right track, because that's a real statement that their purpose is to serve their patients and not the commercial interests of the drug companies. So there are many issues that the drug companies don't want your doctors to know. And a lot of this comes out in litigation, and it's like living in two separate universes, what we learn in litigation. I mean, Pfizer, on October 16th, the biggest drug company, Pfizer, was sentenced to the largest criminal fine ever in U.S. history for fraudulent marketing of five drugs. The biggest part of that fine was $1.3 billion for fraudulent marketing of an arthritis drug called Bextra. I served as a consultant to litigation on the civil side, as well as consulted to the FBI and the Department of Justice on that case. You have to do a lot wrong to get fined $2.3 billion. You have to mislead a lot of doctors with a lot of information that is either untrue or illegal to communicate in a marketing environment. And that's what Pfizer was sentenced to, a felony of fraudulent marketing. It wasn't that they agreed to pay this fine. There was a settlement, but they were guilty of a felony. And it just doesn't register on the American consciousness that to have the biggest drug company guilty of a felony which causes the largest fine in U.S. history means we've got a problem in the way our pharmaceutical industry is conducting business. And yet here we are in the midst of healthcare reform debate, which is the best opportunity we're going to have in a long time. And these issues aren't even getting integrated into the public discussion.
No, they sure aren't. I'll bet what you just said, which is quite astounding, very few people know about.
And there's a reason, Kathleen, they don't know about it, because the drug industry is so good at what they do. Pfizer announced that it was in negotiations with the Department of Justice to pay this fine on the very same day that they announced that they were going to buy Wyeth for $68 billion with $22 billion worth of TARP money, and the story got buried in that. And then on the day that they pled guilty to a felony, October 16th, just 3 weeks ago, happened to be the same day that they announced that they had completed the purchase of Wyeth, and that drowned out the story again.
Oh, my gosh.
Quite a coincidence.
Oof. Thanks, Jane, very much for the call. Let's go next to Bernice is next from Menominee Falls. Hi, Bernice.
Hi. I have two little scenarios, and I'd just like your view on if this is common practice. Number one, I have a Medicare supplement plan with a $50,000 lifetime cap. I'm forced to take the drug plan that this plan covers. In other words, I can't seek out any other Medicare supplement plans or I lose my total insurance and it's not reinstatable. That's the first scenario. The second scenario is that I'm with a mail order drug company and I'm on a diabetic medication and they have three levels of payment. Level one is the lowest that you have to pay. Well, about a year ago, I was on a medication in that lower tier, and then I got this letter saying that that medication no longer qualified, and I was put on a medication from tier two. They put it in tier one, and that was a medication I had to order. And that medication wound up costing me more than the previous drug I was on in tier one. And I just like your comment as to whether these are fairly common practices and if these add to the, you know, profits of the drug company.
Absolutely, Bernice. You've raised two very important issues. The first issue is that you don't have enough choice in the Medicare drug package that you can choose, so you've got to choose one with a $50,000 limit. And this is a perfect example of why we need to have a vigorous public option in our healthcare reform legislation so that people have a choice, and private insurers must compete with a public entity so that the private market has to serve their patients' interests, or people like you, Bernice, will go to the public option where you won't face that kind of restriction. So choice is incredibly important, and I find it ironic that the people who claim that they believe in the markets the most, the insurance industry, are the most afraid of integrating a public option into the menu of choices that really would give let the market work and let the public make informed decisions about how they want to purchase their health care. Mm-hmm. Issue number one. Issue number two is very important. About the diabetic medicine, there are a number of issues that you raised. First of all, if somebody has type 2 diabetes and they're taking one drug, and many people with type 2 diabetes can be controlled with one drug, that drug ought to be a generic drug that's fairly inexpensive. There's no reason to use, or virtually no reason to use, an expensive brand name drug or a tier 2 drug as the first drug in. So, Bernice, I would ask your doctor to see if he or she can choose amongst the Tier 1 drugs because there's no clear advantage of the Tier 2 drugs over the Tier 1 drugs. That's issue number one. But issue number two, I think, is far more important. Bernice, you're taking a drug because you don't want to have the complications of diabetes. You want to live as healthy and long as you possibly can, and you want to minimize the risk that diabetes will compromise the enjoyment or the quality of your health. To that end, it's so important to know that, yes, taking a drug is important and controlling your blood sugar is important in the short term, but exercising and eating a healthy diet is far more important in terms of controlling your diabetes and controlling your drug costs. Drug costs go down when diabetics exercise and eat a healthy diet. And one of the most important points I see, Kathleen, you pushed me a little bit on what do I mean by the knowledge that's wasting the money. And this is a good example, and I talk about this in Overdosed America, but if you get 250 diabetics and you put them on a cholesterol-lowering statin drug, which is recommended and is beneficial, you'll save one life a year. Now, that's enormously important, and every doctor should do it. But if you get those 250 diabetics exercising, you'll save five lives a year. Hmm. So it's five times more important to address the lifestyle side of this than the drug side of this. Yet it's easier and quicker for physicians. We all sort of believe in this myth of biomedicine, that that's the real way to health. And we forget about the side of individual responsibility and that Mother Nature made our bodies in a way that health is expressed by living a certain way in the world. And many of the diseases that we have are caused by deviations of that way of life. And right. We've got to get back to it.
Yeah. Let me ask you before we go back to phone calls and take a pause here, Dr. Abramson. This seems to be just, you know, a huge mess here. And I'm wondering, what kind of system do we need to design that would be fair to, because we live in a for-profit system, or maybe, you know, we shouldn't in healthcare, but we're nowhere near that, so that pharmaceutical companies can make enough money to do the research to bring sometimes absolutely marvelous drugs to the market to make people healthier when they need those kinds of drugs, so that they can make a fair profit in doing this. I mean, what do we do? What's fair for them?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I believe in the free market, and I believe in independent drug companies, and I even believe that drug companies should fund a significant amount of the research because they're the ones who are going to reap the benefits. I mean, Jane called and asked about, or maybe it was Scott. Yeah, Scott called and asked about drug companies being the beneficiary of the basic science research that's publicly funded. Well, I think it's fair for pharmaceutical companies to pay for their research. But I think there are two key issues that would go a long way to straighten this out. First of all, the knowledge that it is comes out to create beliefs in doctors and consumers that certain drugs and procedures are beneficial, is that knowledge functions as a public good, and yet it is produced for its commodity value. Mm. And there needs to be oversight of mm-hmm. the integrity of that knowledge, mm-hmm. the same way financial reports need to be audited by accounting companies that don't have conflicts of interest. So we need this medical effectiveness review board that's mentioned sort of on the tangent of healthcare reform. But unless that medical effectiveness review board is armed with subpoena power, so the drug companies can't hide negative studies and can't misrepresent studies the way we see the article about Neurontin in last week's New England Journal showing. Unless there's subpoena power and criminal penalties for withholding information or misrepresenting information to the Medical Effectiveness Review Board, where doctors are never going to know the most effective way, they're not going to be able to bring the wonderful benefits of medical science to their patients. So we need a medical effectiveness review board that has teeth. Mm-hmm. That's issue number one. Issue number two is patents are granted to drug companies to create an incentive for them to invest the time and the money to develop new drugs so that they can make a profit on those drugs. But once those drugs are out, the United States is the only country that allows drug companies to charge whatever the market will bear. And in essence, we Americans are hostage to the maximum pricing that the drug companies can get away with. And that's, I think, the whole premise of the show today is drug companies increase their prices 9% in anticipation of healthcare reform that might clip their wings a little bit. Well, they're going to continue to do whatever they can to maximize their profits. Right. That's their job. And I think there needs to be a public understanding that their job is to make money and that there needs to be some kind of hybrid between the thinking of the drug companies as independent corporations and as public utilities because they have been given the privilege and responsibility of providing products that are going to improve our health, and yet they've been given the right to exploit us to the max, and there needs to be some public-private rebalancing.
Yeah. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest, Dr. John Abramson, he's the author of Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. He's on the clinical faculty at Harvard Medical School, where he teaches health policy, and he has worked as a family doctor in Appalachia with the National Health Service Corps and for 20 years in Hamilton, Massachusetts. The doctor serves as an expert for plaintiffs' attorneys in litigation involving the pharmaceutical industry. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Ray from Milwaukee. Hi, Ray. Ray, are you there? Ray is not there. Scott from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Just a little side note, I guess, more than anything else. And I take a different perspective on this. And I think in the climate we live right now, it's very easy to demonize companies in the United States. Oil is bad, pharmaceutical is bad, insurance is bad. They're all evil corporations. And the context I take it in is my father is alive because of pharmaceutical companies. I mean, these are remarkable, remarkable organizations that have done a great service to the population as a whole. Now, I'm not saying they're perfect. I'm not saying that they need to be held accountable. But the one thing they shouldn't be is they shouldn't be demonized. And we do that a lot in the United States. Now, we demonize corporations. Corporations are bad. Big pharma is bad. Big oil is bad. Big insurance is bad. And these are organizations that really have improved the quality of life for millions of people. They do need to be held accountable, but we need to stop demonizing organizations.
Dr. Abramson. Oops, I'm afraid our phone is bad again. Hold on a second. Can you hear me, Doctor? Yeah, the phone went out again, so we're going to need to get him back, and we'll get an answer to your thoughts. I'll write them down, and we'll be sure and ask him that question. Thanks very much, Scott. And we go next to Rick. We'll just take your questions and get answers as soon as we get the doctor. How's that? Hi, Rick from Black River Falls.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Rick.
I'm not sure if you saw that story last week of how Pfizer had a whole neighborhood bulldozed in New London, Connecticut for their new factory. They did an eminent domain thing, which was controversial, and hundreds of people lost their homes. And then 5 years later, they closed the factory and laid off 1,500 workers and left town, you know, even after all those subsidies and bulldozings of homes and disruption of whole neighborhoods just so they could have that factory. Then they closed up their factory and left town. I think it's the most disgusting, sickening thing I've ever heard of by a corporation.
Where did they go? Where did Pfizer go?
Well, they just closed the plant and left town. Nobody knows where they went. They probably, you know, did that because they got that TARP money and they laid off 10,000 workers, and that was probably part of that deal too.
Yeah.
You know, that's criminal activity in my book.
All right, let's get response. Dr. Abramson, while we lost connection with you, Scott from Green Bay called and talked about his father who was saved by a drug that was on the market, and that we tend to bash corporations, and they do need to be held accountable, but there's too much demonizing of corporations.
I applaud Scott's comments. It's absolutely true, and there are pharmaceuticals that are...
Hello?
You've reached John and Charlotte. I'm sorry, neither of us are here right now.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know what's happening. His phone just keeps cutting out. Let's try once again.
Tone, please record your message.
Our message
when you
is...
When you've finished recording...
Our message is, where are you, Dr. Abramson? I don't know. We're just having problems with that phone. I'm sorry, everybody, but it's interesting to hear your comments. Let's go to Chuck from Milwaukee next. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. Yeah, this is Chuck in Milwaukee.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi. Yeah, I have a comment about the issue of conflict of interest, particularly about ill-advised or unnecessary surgery. And there's a lot of reports about surgery that didn't have to happen or other interventions that would have been better than surgery. And I'm wondering if the doctor would think that it's a good idea to have a panel of physicians who would recommend a certain procedure or surgery, but then none of those physicians on the panel would be the actual surgeon.
Hmm.
And the surgery then would be referred to another practicing surgeon, so that would avoid the whole issue of conflict of interest, and it would also bring in more people to make a decision about the advisability of us.
Yeah. Do you feel you've been a victim of that, Chuck?
I haven't, but a friend of mine was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and he went to he had the money to go around to get different opinions, and he went to somebody that had offered robotic surgery, and the guy said, you have to get it immediately. And then he went to somebody else who used the knife, and he said, yeah, you got to do this immediately. And he went to somebody else who also said, yeah, let's do it. And then he went out to the top guy in the country, imaging guy at UCLA, and he said, you don't have to have any surgery at all. You're not in danger.
Hmm.
And so the whole question of, you know, it's like this is their bread and butter, doing
yeah.
surgery, and I'm glad there are surgeons. When you need surgery, it's, you know.
Right. You have a good suggestion. We may not get to it today, but we will later. We only have about 30 seconds left. Dr. Abramson, you were responding to Scott, if you want to just finish up.
I sure do. And I want to thank Scott for his comments. There, many drugs are godsends, and it's important not to demonize the corporations. It's also important to understand that what we're seeing, for the most part, is not irrational behavior on the drug industry. It's very rational. Their fiduciary obligation is to their shareholders, not the public. And it's in the public interest to rebalance how those pharmaceutical industries have to behave in the marketplace in order to generate the profits that they're trying to make. So it's the context in which the pharmaceutical industry or any other industry is functioning, not that mm-hmm. they're bad and not that they're...
Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. John Abramson. The book is Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine, published in 2004, with a third edition published in 2008. Interesting hour, wasn't it? And we will invite somebody from the pharmaceutical industry to hear another side of this story, preferably somebody from Pfizer. Thank you, Rhonda Fanning. John Treader will return.